So Ankh told me that over the last several weeks you've been talking about the paramis, these perfections. In this Theravada tradition there are 10 of them, as you know. And in the very early layers of the Buddhist text, the earliest teachings, they're less emphasized. These are teachings that came later, especially the emphasis on perfecting them in the in the service of becoming a Buddha. These are much later teachings. It's said that one can have the aspiration to become a Buddha and then one must perfect each of these qualities to the maximum. I don't know about you, but for me, I'm much more pragmatic. Becoming a Buddha, well, maybe next life. or maybe not at all. Maybe I just want to be a good person. Maybe you just want to be a good person. Maybe you want just to live your life in a way that is, live your life to the fullest. Maybe you just want a little calm, a little happiness. But the wonderful thing about these teachings on the paramis is, even if we don't kind of take that whole framework too seriously, that framework of becoming a Buddha and perfecting them, using these as a framework can be very helpful in our lives. To take each of these qualities and polish it. Each of the qualities that is a parami is a source of happiness, a source of balance, a source of ease in one's life, and really directly benefits our meditation practice and our life in the world. In Burma, often what happens is people, and it's right about this time of year, actually, people come to the monastery to practice for a week, for a month. Right now, the monasteries in Burma are full of people practicing meditation. It's the New Year holiday, and so people come. In our monastery, there are 600 people coming to practice. It's not a big place. Jammed in there like sardines, and everybody's meditating. And they take this time in their lives to do intensive meditation practice. And sometimes they'll come in the rains retreat from July to October and maybe take temporary ordination and to really intensively practice. Intensive practice is just what it says. It's intensive. It's not meant to be practiced all day long in your outer life. And it's not meant to be practiced for huge, long periods of time like that, because it's very difficult practice. It's very challenging. And so, often what the saitos, what the teachers in Burma will do, is they'll track somebody in their practice. And when they hit a plateau where there's nothing new being realized, And the practice is kind of stagnated. It's really not going anywhere. They'll say, okay, now it's time to go home and polish your paramis. And so this practice of taking these paramis and polishing them is very, very, very useful. Because in doing this, we have to be mindful. We have to pay attention. We have to know what we're doing in order to polish our paramis. We have to know whether they're present or absent, just very simply. And we have to have got, oh, yeah, okay, right now I'm not feeling loving kindness. To pause in that moment is a moment of mindfulness. So tonight, loving kindness, the next parami, metta in Pali. I actually prefer that word to the English translation of loving kindness. An even better translation is very simply goodwill. Loving kindness is a complicated translation. It's received kind of general approval. Everybody uses it. But we have kind of a feeling when we use these words, loving kindness, that is often confused with emotion, with mind states that are closer related to attachment. Metta is simply the wish for the welfare and benefit of living beings. It's goodwill. It's in English, this word I keep using, benevolence.
Malevolent.
Towards ourselves and towards others. It's a very, very cool, chilled out mind state when it's well developed. My teacher in Burma, my metta teacher in Burma, U Indica, likes to talk about metta aircon, metta air conditioning. Yeah, I really like that metaphor. Because the heat of ill will, of irritation, of fear, of anxiety, of anger, it's not there when metta is well developed. And it's the direct antidote to ill will and fear. This is how it was originally taught by the Buddha. And this is how it's best used, most effectively used. It's quite amazing what can happen. And actually, the reason I'm here sitting in front of you like this, dressed as I am, living the life that I am, is because of an experience I had in my very first Vipassana retreat. The very first full day of my very first Vipassana retreat. I had come with a friend. I didn't know her well, but she was a friend. And the first full morning of the retreat, she was doing her yogi job in a way that was affecting a whole lot of other people. She was in her little bubble, just doing her thing, not at all aware of what was going on around her. All sorts of people were being affected. And I got annoyed by this. I got really angry at this, actually. Annoyed is too mild a word. And I spent the next hour and a half Every time I see her feet go by. She's such a hypocrite. And I was, you know, noticing this anger. I was practicing. I'd feel it, stay with it. It would go away for a moment, and then it would come right back, full of thinking and, oh well, anger and irritation. And at one point, I was just paying attention clearly to these sensations. And there was a moment of realizing, I'm really pissed off. I'm really angry. And I knew metta was the antidote to this. So not even using the phrases, but just, can I care about myself and the suffering this is causing? Can I care about my friend? And I brought this, there was a moment of just, and then continuing to do the vipassana. And it was something I had never experienced in my entire life of many years. After doing that, in a moment of carefully and kindly paying attention to my experience, and the word is kindly, it's like, well, this is what is happening, can I care about this? Having that attitude of metta and goodwill, in a blink of an eye, suddenly observing that, the anger just melted. It just, in a moment, it completely dissolved. But what was so clear in that moment is the experience that replaced it, not just towards myself and to her, but to everybody in the room, was this incredible care and connection of metta. The anger broke and it fell into an openness of heart and a care and connection that I'd never felt in my entire life. It was mind-boggling. It's like the anger is gone and it wasn't coming back. Wow. And I saw that when the heart is full of metta, anger is impossible. Now, of course, anger has come back. You know, I wasn't awakened completely in that moment. But it woke me up to the possibility that with care and goodwill and a willingness to allow myself to be and to allow others to be just as they are, habits of a lifetime could not have traction. Unwholesome habits of a lifetime could not have traction. And this goodwill, this well-wishing, this kindness, this interest, this care, is a happy state. It's very pleasant to feel that. It's like, wow. And with this care and attention, when we have it, just as I want to be happy, so may you be happy. And there are no strangers in the world. When we connect with that, sure, I don't know your names. I don't speak Dutch. Please forgive me. I don't know a lot about your lives and even this culture. But we share this common humanity. We all want to be happy. And we can all offer each other that wish for happiness. And this well-wishing, this goodwill, this kindness. Another meaning of this word that's embedded in the grammar, actually, of the word, metta, is mitra, friendliness. Can we be friendly with ourselves and with each other? And when somebody's a really good friend, we'll give them a lot of slack. Yeah, okay, you know, we know the things they do that bother us. But we care. And we don't kind of push them out of our hearts because of something that might annoy us. And it's the same with metta. Metta has this quality of the word in English is actually immeasurable. It doesn't measure. It doesn't say, oh, you're worthy and you're not. I'm not worthy, they're worthy. Everybody is worthy of this goodwill, this care, this friendly, kind, heartfelt wish for happiness. It's also called boundless. Without boundary, without barrier. So what that means also is that there's no distinction between the kindness and well-wishing towards myself, towards a stranger, towards an enemy, towards all beings. And this is said when we cultivate loving-kindness, as many of you are doing this week, when we cultivate it deeply and over time, the barriers we have in our hearts begin, well, basically that cultivation dismantles those walls, those barriers we have in here between ourselves and other people. Not in a way that's kind of mushy and when we have metta, we know our conventional, this is me and this is you, and our proper places and roles. It's not like we merge with each other. But that metta for myself is indistinguishable from the metta that I might have for an enemy or a dear friend. We just can't see any difference. And people notice this when they begin to practice for a while. After they've been going for a while, it's like, wow, that's really interesting. The metta I feel for myself doesn't feel any different than the metta for my friend, or the metta for a neutral person, or for an enemy. In the text, it talks about loving kindness in terms of near and far enemies. Of the near enemy of loving kindness being selfish attachment or sentimental attachment. So this is the attachment we feel for the nearest and dearest, our family, our best friends, our partners. That's love, attached love. That's not metta. Metta is much more chilled out than that. It's much more boundless than that. And the far enemy of metta, of course, is ill will. So when we cultivate this state, we're constantly inclining the mind. May you be well, happy, and peaceful. May you be well, happy, and peaceful. May you be well, happy, and peaceful. And the heart opens to this person. It's a magical process. But to understand this business of the near enemy is an important thing. Because we can feel goodwill and have that strong wish for another's well-being, no matter what. But we don't have to love them or even be associated with them. So in the one of the protective paritta chants that's traditionally done is this chant where I feel well-wishing for beings with 4 feet, beings with 2 feet, beings with no feet. May they be well, may they be happy. And then at the very end of the chant, it says, I've made this safeguard. May the beings depart. So basically, this is a chant. The abbot of our monastery does it every day so that the snakes don't come in the monastery. May the beings depart. I don't want anything to do with you guys, but may you be well. It doesn't say eight-footed being, but spiders too, you know. It's like, okay, guys, may you be well, but not in here. And the same goes for people that are toxic. There are toxic people in the world. It doesn't deny that. It doesn't pretend that, you know, everybody's nice. It doesn't mean that we need to be open and loving to all beings, even if they're toxic. No, it's like, may you be happy. Not near me. That's okay. We can have boundaries. And it's not a passive kind of saccharine, we say in English, state. It's not like really sugary sweet. It's just, may you be happy. It doesn't deny difficulty. It doesn't deny that sometimes people do and say things that are painful, harmful. And sometimes metta speech and metta action, action imbued with metta, speech imbued with metta, sometimes these can be, that's not okay. Please don't do that. It's the energy, though, with which we say and do these things that matters. So is there goodwill? Is there well-wishing or is there anger? That's what makes the difference. And metta speech can be very direct. My preceptor and teacher, Upandita, was well known for scaring people. If your practice was not sincere, if that was his perception, you'd come in and report and he'd say, he'd go, don't waste my time. And what that meant was, get out of here. Go practice until you have something to report that's, you know. But it was, the words were strong. I've had him say to me, not good enough. But the strong words always, always came from a place of, I know what you're capable of, and I want you to be happy. So please continue your practice. I always felt this heartfelt metta from him. So, metta is not passive. It also doesn't mean we associate with people we shouldn't associate with. Again, in the Paritas, the protective chants, it says very clearly, association with the wise, not associating with fools. This is the highest blessing. So we can pick and choose our friends wisely. We don't have to kind of passively just be nice outwardly to everybody. It means we're truthful. It means we say what we need to say with a heart of loving kindness. That's the art of this. It's not necessarily easy. It doesn't mean we just blast everybody, but we carefully consider our words. Are they true? Are they useful? Is this the right time to say this? Can the person receive it? And most importantly, do I have goodwill and friendliness towards this person? Or am I just angry? Do I just want to vent? And if that's the case, then don't say it. And this is an interesting practice. It's not easy. It's really not easy. Because it forces us to observe and to look. So, this observing and looking is mindfulness. And you can't do metta practice without having it. You can't use metta in your daily life without having this mindfulness. And yet, it goes in the other direction too. Because if you're doing metta practice, you can't do it without mindfulness. But if you're doing vipassana practice, mindfulness practice, you absolutely must have an attitude of loving kindness. It manifests as an attitude of interest, of friendliness, of care. You need to care about your experience and be interested in it, whatever it is. This is that boundless quality of metta. So maybe something's coming up in your meditation practice that is not acceptable. You don't like it. You don't want it. But there it is. The attitude of metta that can receive that and notice it and see it as it is vital for the practice. And it's absolutely important in our lives as well. Metta can be practiced at any time, in any place. All of you who are doing this city retreat, this sandwich retreat, know that it can be practiced also intensively. Metta is one of the four, what's called Brahma-viharas, the four divine abodes. And I love that because it's a happy space. It's a joyful space. To feel this simple well-wishing. And when we practice it, either intensively or in our daily lives, it brings that joy. Because all the walls we build in our hearts take a lot of energy to maintain, and they separate us from each other. And as a Brahma-vihara, a divine abode, this was the Buddha's definition of his own practice. Somebody once asked him, "Well, what do you do? What is your experience in the day? What does your practice look like?" And there's a very beautiful chant that we often do that is verbatim what he said. I abide pervading the four quarters, the directions, with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. This is a description of loving kindness as a Brahma-vihara. Boundaryless, without barriers. Exalted, because it really is. It's not our everyday way of being. But that said, it's very practical. It's very pragmatic. It's relational. And without hostility, without ill will. And the Buddha lived like this. He didn't have to make any effort to do that. We do, because we haven't polished that parami. This is where the Brahma-viharas and the paramis come together. We polish this parami of metta by practicing it intensively, by developing it through specific practice, or by just in our daily lives, inclining the mind again and again and again to that mind state. We make it a habit. And we polish that parami of metta until it is abundant, exalted, immeasurable. The cool thing, the wonderful thing, is that we're not Buddhas. Well, I'm not a Buddha. But it's accessible to all of us. Maybe just for a moment, or maybe for a little longer. And maybe, yes, we have to exert some effort, some energy to incline the mind in that direction again and again. But it's not something divine in the sense that only the gods can experience this. It's more divine in the sense of when we have this quality as human beings, we all can. We are living as the gods do. And every single person has this capacity. It's our nature. We just have to remember to incline the mind there again. All of us have habits, different habits, and some are wholesome, some are unwholesome, but to bring the heart again and again and again to loving kindness creates a habit and a stream of habit that when it picks up momentum, you can't stop it. It's really quite wonderful. And yeah, there are times when people make us angry, or when somebody does something that is just unbelievably terrible. It's hard to have loving kindness towards these beings, but it's possible. We don't have to approve, but we can wish them well. And often, particularly for very difficult people in our immediate personal lives or in the world at large, for beings like this, the doorway that is an opening to loving kindness, to well wishing for them, is actually compassion, which is loving kindness that is directed towards suffering. And when we understand, not only are they deeply unhappy, but they are creating causes and conditions for even more unhappiness for themselves in the future, the heart can just soften around whatever it is they're doing. Like, oh. May they be free of suffering. Now and in the future. And it's not going to be pretty for them. So, metta and compassion together are the doorways into a softening of heart. That is this, the heart that is willing to connect with others. No matter what. With kindness, with care. And with a friendly interest. So that's enough words from me. Let's rest in the silence for a moment, and then there's plenty of time for questions.